Hi, and welcome to the magazine Rack on Chris. I'm June Holliday. Today, I'll be reading from the June 2024 issue of Reader's Digest. Let's begin with a drama in real life entitled, When a Snake Fell from the Sky. The woman on the lawnmower thought that was bad, especially when it hit her. Then the hawk swooped in. By Derek Burnett. 8 billion people inhabit planet Earth. 30 million live in Texas. Residents of the town of Silsby, just west of the Louisiana state line, number roughly 7,000. Let's estimate, for the sake of argument, that on any given Tuesday evening, 20 of those Silsby residents are out cutting their grass. Out of all those 20 mowers and 7,000 Silsby residents and 30 million Texans and 8 billion humans, only one that we know of, 65-year-old Peggy Jones, was unlucky enough to have a living, writhing snake fall out of the sky and onto her. The story only gets weirder. Peggy and her husband, Wendell Jones, were tending a property they own just outside the Silsby city limits on July 25th, 2023. Wendell was out front, weed-eating, while Peggy drove a tractor, Kubota 26 horsepower, pulling a mowing machine around the big piece of open land out back. They'd waited till evening to do the work, avoiding the nearly 100-degree temperatures of the afternoon. Out of sight and earshot of Wendell, Peggy was lost in thought, hands on the wheel, when suddenly a 3.5 to 4 foot snake dropped out of the clear blue sky onto her right forearm. This is not something one expects to happen. At that particular moment, I don't know if I realized it was a snake, Peggy says. You're out here. There's grasshoppers and little flying bugs. So you automatically just kind of sling it off. Just an automatic reaction. And that's exactly what I did. But this creature did not sling. It clung, having immediately coiled itself tightly around her arm. A millisecond later, when she realized that the creature on her arm was a snake, and a big one, she shrieked and flailed more wildly. She had no idea what kind of snake the heavens had favored her with, nor did she much care to know. To me, she says, a snake is a snake. The story is just getting going, but let's pause here to settle a couple of questions. First, why would a snake fall out of the sky? Two main reasons, according to Vincent Cobb, a snake expert from Middle Tennessee State University. Sometimes snakes lose their footing, as it were, and tumble from trees onto unfortunate passers-by. And sometimes they're dropped by a hawk that had been meaning to eat them. In this case, there was no tree, which implicates the hawk. But, second question, if a snake falls from the sky onto an outstretched forearm, would it really wrap itself around the arm just that fast? Or wouldn't it kind of slide off and slither away through the grass? The snake could very likely have hit the arm and then fallen to the ground, Cobb says. But I'm not surprised it wrapped around her arm, because that's a safety response. Snakes don't have legs and arms. It landed on something. The only way it can hang on is to wrap around it. So we continue with the story, having established that Peggy Jones was doubly unlucky. She'd been directly beneath a clumsy hawk, and the snake that hit her was blessed with superior reflexes, fixing itself instantaneously to her arm, not like a constrictor aiming to crush its prey, but like a beast with no intention to leave, squeezing just hard enough to bruise. No amount of flailing could rid her of the reptile, which now began striking at her face. If that's not sufficiently appalling, allow Peggy to make it even worse. Take your hand and hold it at arm's length and look at it, she says. That's about the size of your hand. But now put your hand up to your face. It looks huge, right? To me, this snake looked like a super huge monster coming at me. leaning and straining her head, neck, and shoulder as far away from her right arm as possible, Peggy screamed for Wendell. After a few seconds, she realized he wasn't coming. She was alone in this battle, so she appealed to the only being that could conceivably be of aid. "Help me, Jesus," she yelled. Cobb emphasizes that in striking repeatedly at Peggy, the snake was not just being mean. It was terrified. "It just got through being attacked by a hawk," he says. "It falls on her arm and wraps itself around, just trying to hang on to what it fell onto. And then it sees this woman's face 2 feet from it. The snake sees this as another predator. That's why the snake is striking at her face. It wasn't attacking her. It was defending itself." With the tractor still rolling, the mower still cutting, Peggy still screaming and flinging, and Wendell still blissfully weed-eating out front, Peggy's consciousness was abruptly invaded by yet another burst of sensory input too bizarre to register. Now a hawk was there on her arm, clutching at the snake with its razored talons, furiously beating its wings around and above her head in a thunderous flapping thrum. Her heart nearly beat through her sternum. To make sense of this startling development, let's now learn a little about hawks. Why would one drop a snake from the sky? And would a hawk really brave a noisy tractor and a shrieking human to go back for its lost prey? Kevin McGowan, a biologist at the Lab of Ornithology at Cornell University, says it's not that uncommon for a hawk to drop a snake. "It's hard to be a hawk," he explains. "They have to learn how to catch stuff and kill it without getting hurt and letting it get away. And that's not easy to do." Rural folklore holds that hawks kill snakes by deliberately dropping them from on high, sometimes aiming specifically for barbed wire fences. "Not likely," says McGowan. "When snatched up by a hawk, unless they've been instantly dispatched, snakes might wrap around the bird's feet, a wing, or its body. If the snake is wriggling and trying to fight back," he says, "the hawk could lose its grip while it's flying along." Cobb concurs. "The hawk has to drop it or maybe go down with the snake." Indeed, both experts are aware of cases in which hawks have been done in by their serpentine prey. So, okay, the hawk drops the snake accidentally, or perhaps out of sheer self-preservation. But would a hawk really plunge down to retrieve its prey from a human astride a chugging tractor with a clattering mower behind? "It strikes me as pretty weird," McGowan says. "This is an extraordinarily unusual occurrence. Most hawks are scared of people. This one should have been, but apparently wasn't." But he has a theory that might explain this unusually bold behavior. "It's conceivable this is a young bird, hatched this year and still trying to figure out how to do things," he says. "This hawk hadn't learned the classic life lesson about just letting some things go. I mean, if it's a big snake, it's a big hunk of meat and you hate to lose it," McGowan says. "So the hawk certainly would have the urge to retrieve it." Quick tally of Peggy Jones's abysmally bad luck thus far in the story. Hawks don't usually drop their prey, but this one did, managing to hit her with it. Snakes don't always catch themselves and wrap around the thing they landed on, but this one did. And to cap it off, not all hawks are feckless juveniles just learning their trade and thus foolish enough to come back for their fumbled prey. But this one seems to have been. We continue. The hawk seized the snake and pulled with such power that Peggy could feel it lift her arm forcefully skyward. "I felt a good tug," she says, "but that's when you could feel that the snake was holding on tight." Before Peggy could react, the hawk flew off empty-handed, as it were. "Not surprising," says Cobb. "Snakes are quite muscular, and those coils are hard to break." For the briefest moment, Peggy was left alone again with an even more beleaguered snake as the tractor zigzagged crazily up toward the mobile homes the couple rent out. But as quickly as the hawk had disappeared, it reappeared, again beating the air about Peggy's head, again clutching and slashing at her arm with its talons. Again, the hawk failed and departed. A moment later, another pass, another vicious grabbing, another failure. "Oh, my Lord, please help me. Something's got to give here," Peggy thought. And something did give. The snake, weakened from constant attacks by the hawk's talons, on its fourth sortie, the bird of prey managed to yank the snake off Peggy's arm and abscond with its meal. Peggy was now snake and hawk free, but she was still not mollified. Looking at her bloodied forearm, all she could think was, "This is not good." Her flesh had been brutally torn, bruised, and punctured. She stopped the tractor, reeling with adrenaline. Wendell, who had just finished out front, was there beside her now, having heard her screams, and was begging to know what was wrong. She tried to tell him, but was so upset that her words were unintelligible. Wendell loaded his injured wife into their truck and raced toward the hospital. During the drive, he got her calmed enough that he could begin to understand what she was saying. It sounded like she said that a snake fell out of the air. "A snake?" he said. "A snake did all that to your arm?" "No," she answered, frustrated. "The hawk did that to me." She managed to convey the broadest outlines of what happened, but then a new realization hit her. She was having trouble seeing out of her right eye. "Okay," Wendell said, "we're almost there, we're almost there." At the emergency room entrance, he helped her out of the vehicle. "Oh," he said, "there's something on your glasses. That's why you can't see." He removed the glasses and the cloudiness that had blocked her vision vanished. The ER workers cleaned her wounds and carefully inspected her skin for snake bites, miraculously finding none, and wiped from the right lens of her eyeglasses a milky yellowish fluid. "There was venom on my glasses," Peggy said, "and there was a little chip in them. They weren't chipped before this." With no sign of having been bitten, she was bandaged, put on a course of antibiotics, and released. Three questions remain. Was that really venom on her glasses? What kind of snake was it? And what kind of hawk? Definitive answers to these three are impossible to come by. The fluid from the lens was never tested. At the hospital, all those assembled assumed it was venom because a snake had been involved. Vincent Cobb acknowledges that that venom is yellowy and viscous as described, but for this to have been venom and for Peggy not to have been bitten would be so freakishly unlikely that his gut tells him it was some other substance, perhaps mouth secretions from the snake. Then again, he concedes, it could have been venom. After all, what other parts of this story aren't freakishly unlikely? Regarding the snake's ID, all Peggy Jones can tell you is that the creature was dark in color and long. She and Wendell figured out it measured between 3.5 and 4 feet by wrapping a tape measure twice around her forearm and extending it back to her face. On the scant information, Cobb says the specimen of interest could be any of 6 to 8 species, including the pine, speckled king, prairie king, Texas rat, coach whip, and southern black racer. If the snake was indeed venomous, adds Cobb, that probably narrows it to the timber rattlesnake or perhaps the cottonmouth. McGowan is closer to confident about the species of hawk. "Sometimes we say it's a red-tailed until proven otherwise," he says, noting that red-tailed hawks are the most often observed species hunting in the open and perching on poles and fences. But it could also have been a red-shouldered hawk, Far less likely, yet possible, McGowan says, would be a Swainson's hawk. It's taken longer for Peggy's psyche to heal than her arm. The encounter still haunts her. For months after the incident, she scarcely slept. Every time she closed her eyes, she would relive the terrifying ordeal. Fangs, feathers, talons. But too tough to be defeated by nightmares, she has returned to working outdoors. She's made but one change in response to the nasty tricks Mother Nature played on her that day. In August, she and Wendell went out and bought her a spanking new zero-turn lawn mower. It has a canopy that covers the whole entire thing, Peggy says. We shopped canopy first and mower second. I got the biggest top that there is. The canopy is built of aluminum tread plate. Peggy made a sign for it, visible from above, a red circle with a line through it, crossing out a wriggling reptile and featuring two simple words, no snakes. Oof, what a weird story. Let's continue now with something hopefully a little less harrowing. These are your true stories, entitled Popping the Question, Engagement Stories from Both Sides of the Bend, by Reader's Digest Readers. A match lit in heaven. Mitch loves cigars, and I love the smell and buying them for him. Every time he smoked one, he'd take the cigar band off and place it on my finger. On our one-year anniversary, we took a motorcycle ride to a boisterous Irish pub. He lit up a cigar, and as usual, I put out my hand. He placed the band on my ring finger and asked me to marry him. Once I realized he meant it, I quickly said yes. He asked if I wanted a special ring, and I said yes, but something unfussy that I could wear 24/7. The romantic in him surprised me once again. He designed matching rings shaped like cigar bands with our initials entwined. By Shannon Messenberg, Port Charlotte, Florida. Head over heels and toes. My husband was so excited to propose that he stopped at my pedicure appointment on his way home from the jewelry store. He walked in, showed me the ring, and asked me to marry him in the middle of the nail salon. I said yes and gave him a kiss, and he said he'd see me when I finished. The funniest part is that the nail technician didn't even look up. By Tammy Carpenter Fisher, Dunville, Ontario. A love you can't extinguish. My boyfriend called one day with shocking news. His house burned down while he was at work. We talked about getting engaged soon, and he told me that he'd bought a ring and stored it in his sock drawer. The sight was nothing but ash when we arrived. We ducked under the yellow tape and stood where his bedroom dresser had been, digging through the ash until we came across burned socks. We kept going, soon finding a singed ring box. I opened it and saw the ring. It was tarnished, but intact. When I asked what I should do with it, he blurted, "Put it on!" And just like that, we were engaged. By Barb Weimer, Valparaiso, Indiana. A really personal ad. I wanted to make my proposal memorable for my sweetheart, so I placed an ad in the Los Angeles Times. Susan, you are perfect. I love you forever. Will you marry me? Don. It dawned on me that many others had probably done that already, and I wanted another way to ensure my proposal was one of a kind. The night the ad was published, I directed her to it while standing on my head and eating a cream puff. A flair that certainly made it a first. She loved it and said yes, placing her own ad in the Times. Don, you are perfect. I love you forever. Yes, I will marry you. Susan. Our marriage has been a head-over-heels cream puff since. By Don Sessions, Laguna Beach, California. Take the plunge, not a plunge. Christian and I were kayaking in Pottsburg Creek in Jacksonville, Florida, when I noticed something yellow floating in the water. I paddled closer and said, oh no, someone lost their boat key. I pulled the floating keychain in with my paddle and realized the tag read, will you marry me? The most gorgeous ring was attached to the chain. Christian paddled back to me, asked me to remove my sunglasses, and said the sweetest things about our love before asking me to marry him. Of course, I accepted and struggled not to go overboard as I hugged and smooched my new fiancé. By Chelsea Ornelas, Baxter, Minnesota. Sealing the Dill. One Christmas, my daughter Lexi's boyfriend asked me to help with his proposal. We have an old German tradition of hiding a pickle ornament in a tree, and the finder earns an extra present. On Christmas morning, my other daughter convincingly tussled with Lexi as they searched, but made sure Lexi came up with the pickle. I handed Lexi her bonus present, which she unwrapped with glee, then looked confused when she realized it was a ring. I told her to look to her right, where Justin was kneeling beside her. Lexi was so surprised and happy she burst into tears. They'll be married this September. By Christine Snyder, Del Rapids, South Dakota. Will you marry me? My partner and I had been together for more than 20 years when we decided to update our wills. During a Zoom call, our lawyer asked if we were married. When we said no, he said, why the heck not? I stammered about marriage tax penalties and he countered with a rundown of the benefits. After we hung up, I sheepishly walked into the room where my partner was, got down on one knee, and asked if he would marry me. He grinned, also got on one knee, and asked me the same. We both said yes, then with our bad knees, helped each other up. By H.W., Washington, D.C. A quick title update. My girlfriend and I traveled from California to Oklahoma to visit her family. While we were out shopping, her mother ran into a friend and introduced us. This is my daughter, Trish, she said. Then she turned to me and said, this is David, my daughter's... She paused, unsure how to title me. I looked at Trish and said, will you marry me? Surprised, she said yes. I turned to the other woman and proudly proclaimed, fiancé. By David Chilton, Nashville, Tennessee. The right kind of red flags. I just moved from Ohio to Texas for my boyfriend when his employer suddenly transferred him to the Netherlands. We continued dating long distance and eventually had begun talking about marriage when I received a package containing 7 flag patches with no note of explanation. My first step was to identify the countries, but some weren't country flags at all. Do the striped flags go this way or that? And there was a duplicate. It took some doing, but I finally solved his puzzle. Malaysia, Amsterdam, Russia, Yemen, Morocco, and England. Aha! Marry me! I sent a photo with 3 flags. Yap, Estonia, and Schleswig-Holstein. He still insists, I said, yes. He proposed traditionally on his next trip home, but for me the flag proposal couldn't be topped. We married at the United Nations Chapel in New York City soon after. By Louise Hauser, Sarasota, Florida. Let's conclude today with a story of everyday heroes entitled Surf's Up Again. A Hawaiian helps victims of a devastating fire in the most Hawaiian way possible. By John Rosengren. The fire raced through Lahaina last August so fast that it killed 100 people and destroyed more than 2,200 buildings, most of them homes. It left more than 7,000 people without their possessions and in need of shelter. That afternoon, Callan Lepre, A 36-year-old nutritional therapist grabbed her wallet and her grandmother's pearls and drove out of town. She lost everything else in her 4-bedroom house: clothes, documents, jewelry, GoPro gear, a computer, and 7 surfboards. Laprise surfed almost every day. Surfing was a source of joy and a means to maintain her mental health. Seeing her surfboards reduced to a pile of fibers, especially her prized baby blue Doug Haute custom longboard, was devastating. "I was so in love with that board," she says. Judd Lau understood. The 53-year-old Maui native has been riding the waves since he was a teenager, and he's been building surfboards for the last 15. He knows the value of a good surfboard. "A surfboard is part of your whole being, especially in Hawaii, where surfing originated," he says. "Losing a board is like losing a part of your soul." So, wanting to help the victims in some way, he started thinking about all the surfers who had lost their boards. "And I thought, that's my area of expertise," he says. "Surfing is a healing thing for surfers, getting in the ocean, connecting to Mother Nature." He realized he could give that back to them. Lau started by connecting people who wanted to donate extra boards to those who had lost theirs, about 200 boards total. Friends in Oahu and California collected another 550 boards and shipped them to Maui for Lau to distribute. But many surfers, like Laprise, use custom boards designed to accommodate their size or the type of waves they ride. So Lau solicited cash donations, raising about $20,000 to cover the cost of materials for shaping custom boards to give away. Donating his labor, he made more than 40 boards that typically would have retailed for $600 to $1,500 each. He also enlisted the other shapers on the island, about a dozen of them, to make at least one board apiece, providing around 20 more surfboards. Lau shapes the boards in his studio 35 miles east of Lahaina, carefully designing and crafting them one at a time. He cuts each board from a block of polyurethane foam using a computer-aided machine, then takes an hour or two to finish it by hand with planes and sanding blocks. When that's done, he takes it to the glassing factory next door to be finished with coats of fiberglass and resin. The recipients of Lau's efforts include a Lahaina fireman who fought the blaze but lost his home and his surfboards, a man who had worked in a surf shop Lau managed 30 years ago, and Laprise. She messaged him with what she'd lost, and he shaped her a high-performance 9-foot single-fin board with a sunset fading from yellow to orange and Lahaina in deep red letters in the middle. "I cried when I saw it," Laprise says. "He created an art piece for me and this tool to help me move forward." The new board allowed her to get back in the water and start healing. Her first time out was last September at Yukumahame Beach. She joined hundreds of others in the ocean to honor all that was lost. "Just getting back in the water was one of the more powerful experiences of my life," says Laprise, emotion welling up in her voice. "It's part of the healing you know you need, but you don't know how to get. Feeling joy again helps the moving forward. Judd gifted me back a huge part of my mental health." That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the June 2024 issue of Reader's Digest. I'm June Holiday. So long until next time.